The American poet Robert Frost has written, "Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down the one as far as I could to where it bent in the wider growth, then took the other, as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that the passing here had warned them really about the same. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that made all the difference. All the difference." Choosing your God, choosing your God. Do you realize we choose our God all the time, and we re-choose God all the time? The gods are already in place, it seems to me, when we're born. When we get here and we open our eyes to the world, the culture and the people around us, friend and stranger, are already telling us about the nature of the God we must acknowledge and serve. The landscape of God has been mapped out for us before we get there. Our choices are determined by our place in things, and by our nature, our personality, whether we are rebellious by nature or suppliant. Our tribe will determine it. Our attitude to the world will determine it. So in effect, there is a shopping mall dedicated to choosing your God, and we go there all the time. So let's walk through the shopping mall for a moment. Some people are going to stop at the furniture store, and in the furniture store, they're going to choose their God. And it will be a fashionable God, they hope, a God who reflects good taste, a God with leather trimming, a God with feather bed comfort, a craftsman-built side table and dining room table, just what the doctor ordered, the God that convinces visitors around them that we are a success, the God of the furniture store. Some people are going to look to the God of the hardware store, the God who offers tools for building, blueprints for renovation, dreams formed in drywall and big bay windows to see through, a God who fashions life with us as a master artisan. Some will choose that God, and some will head straight for the bakery. I grew up in a bakery till I was 10, so I know the pull of the bakery. Just put a Portuguese custard tart in front of me and watch the crumbs fly. This will be the God of sweet stimulation and of savory tang, the one who spurs our hunger and then feeds us with good things. That's a good God to seek, we say, a God who leaves us with a full stomach and icing sugar all over our lips. Yummy. Some are going to walk up the stairs to the law office on the second floor. They feel in their life at this point they need to go there. This will be the God who defends, the God who fights for justice, the God who knows and mediates the law. We may not know the laws by which we are ruled, but the one in the law office knows them well, the one who helps us stand trial and to gain restitution, the vengeful, righteous God, if you like, who sees our side and takes our side. And some will wander on to the outfitters, the rugged store for travelers and adventurers, those who in life love to climb and jump and risk, those who give support and seek support, like strong ropes and cables and the right shoe for climbing and all the rest, sturdy boots, waterproof tents to be secure and sheltered overnight. The muscular God, the trailblazing God, will be their choice. And others will spend hours in the bookshop. It's a big mall, by the way. They'll spend hours in the bookshop, and there they'll find what they need. Self-help, biography to see how other people did it, history to see where it came from, and travel, places you can go to find adventure, and philosophy, way to think about the world, and mystery, corners you can't quite get into, and recipes if you want to build some things yourself, and poetry to take you to dreamland, and children's classics to help you remember the days that were. Here is the God of the curious mind and the childlike spirit. We're going to lose some people in the midst of the bookstore, and others are going to go along to the subscription place to renew their memberships in the art gallery or the museum, or to buy tickets in the world of sports, or to get a bus trip to the local casino, that's always fun, or to go to the horse races and bet on the triactor, whatever that is. And then here is the God of emotional stimulation and excitement. Take me someplace and fill my heart and soul with exciting scenes, we say. And others of us will simply sit on a bench along the concourse, and we will think our thoughts privately and personally, wondering about the traditions around us from a distance, and also asking for healing from the traditions around us if they have bitten us or burnt us along the way. The God of private petitions and spiritual personal intimacies is a God we can choose. And if all that weren't enough, each generation chooses a God of a different character from the one that preceded it and the one that follows it. Some choose the bulwark to stop the drift. If I can just get a strong God, I can stay exactly where I am and let the world go by, and I know I'll be safe. And some choose a God who will help us to rage. There is much about in the world about which we must rage. And so if we can help end the oppression with a raging God at our shoulder, we will choose that one. And some choose a God who will help us to accept the seeming inevitability of things. We're just going to ride along and fall off at the end. Oh God, give us comfort with that thought. Or we choose a God who will rescue us from the inevitability of things. If I just have a broad enough vision and I can bring heaven close enough, I won't have to worry about the little thing in the middle called our demise. Generations seek their own God. And I was thinking about this one, and I might have it wrong because our generations intermingle, of course, but I was thinking this generation seems to seek a God who is anxious to break out of tradition. The traditional ways of approaching them are getting rather cold in our contemporary thought. So it's a generation that chooses novelty around the question of the sacred, and also even eccentricity. If you can sit somewhere in the dark or gather with friends around a mantra or light something that smells like incense, do whatever you need to get to that inner spirit, that little bright light. This seems to be a generation that loves the trends, get the newest thing, be compelled by the dazzle that's being presented to us by exploration and invention, a God who will hide us in the white noise of praise, stand in front of the screens and sing the song over and over again, and that way you can keep the pain of the world at arm's length. It seeks a God of pleasure, but also a God of deep anchorage at the same time. A God who appeals to our fun side. It shouldn't be boring to go on the quest for the deity, but who will also drive us safely home at the end of the night when the party is over. That's an interesting mix. And watching all of these things with cold eyes are the gods of special interests. They sit on high walls and they are never touched, no matter how much the generations change. The gods of ideologies that make us rigid, and the gods of tribalism that make us dangerous to one another, and the gods of elitism to make us feel as if we're entitled to things, and thus we refuse to see our place in the world of troubles. The God of this generation speaks with a different voice. The young want a God who will help them open doors. I get that. The people in middle years want a God who will steady the ship. Please help me to hold my schooling and my work and my family and my thoughts and my hormones all in a comfortable and useful pattern. Amen. And the people in old age want a God who gathers up precious things and leads us safely to a harbor somewhere where we will be all right. So here we are on a playing field of gods, and we're changing the players all the time. That's the nature of being alive. And yet each of us has a compass inside somewhere. You can't put your fingers on it, but you can feel that it's there. A compass in a sense of rightness, a sense of how it ought to be, deeply. Not because someone tells you it ought to be that way, but you just feel as part of your being, to be part of all this cosmos, and to be part of the simple little things day by day. We have an inner sense, a compass, as to how it is to be, how to be in the flow, how to feel you have a rudder and a sail with you and a keel beneath your ship. And I believe we trust that God most of all. If the culture tells us one thing and takes us too far, and the churches tell us another thing and take us too far in the other direction, we will trust that inner compass first and foremost. And I feel that that is mostly a healthy thing. So the Joshua text, read by the chief this morning, illustrates an occasion for choosing your God. Every so often, it's important when people are gathering up the history of their tribe to give them moments of focus. Come now, in the face of all we've seen and done, and be together, and let's get to the root of it and choose the anchorage one more time. So this was such an occasion. And the advice is, begin with the founding story that makes you who you are. Do you know the founding story that makes us who we are? The ancient people of Israel said, this is who we are, and this is how we got here, and our choice of God is going to arise from that experience. Once you anchor the story of who you are and how you got here, then the God you need and the God you seek becomes a little clearer. Now, I'm sure not everyone in the tribes of ancient Israel felt this way, but the writer of the book of Joshua said, folks, this is the story out of which we have come. It involved wandering and enslavement and then a cry from us to be rescued and then a rescue and then leadership in a period of wilderness and then a sensed promised land which we eventually reached and then a whole bunch of wrestling as to how to live safely and honorably in the land we've been given with a variety of kings and good and terrible political leadership and wars that we didn't want and wars that we did want and all the rest of the things we know. If our sensed deep story is different from that, and it may well be, then the God we choose will be different. The biblical God may not be the God we choose in this generation. Do you feel we're drifting? Just drifting. That will call a different God to the fore. Are we without worth or meaning? Is this just all a dumb show of some kind? A different God will emerge. Are we on some karmic wheel? Are we subject to blind fate, do you think? What kind of deity would step forward to help us then? To reach greatness out of nothing seems like an impossible accomplishment, so we can do better. The Joshua text also says, choose your God, mindful of the gods chosen in the land in which you dwell. And as I read that, it was the word dwell that struck me. We are dwellers here. We don't live here. We're not going to be here forever. We're simply dwelling. We dwell in tents, tentatively, as my friend Robert Raines would say. So we're only dwelling. We're just passing through. So beware of gods that lead us to dead ends and closed doors and wasted visions and too much certainty to go with the reality of our life. Beware of the simpler choices that are being made in the culture round about us. I found the most challenging part of this text, the little bit of news at the end. Did you hear it? Go ahead and choose God if you want, but you can't choose God. What? Go ahead and serve God if you want. Make all your promises, but you can't serve God. And if you choose to serve God and you mess it up, you're going to pay big time because God doesn't like to be toyed. What kind of God is that? Well, it seems to me that whatever the text is about, it is saying that whatever God is, it is a profound mystery, more than we can ever grasp and ever control. We don't choose God. We lean into the idea, concept, and experience of what might be God, and we trust it, and we allow our lives to be turned in its direction, and in so doing, we grow and change and ingest all the things that happen to us along the way, and slowly we build a sense that we belong to something more than words, deeper than full human experience, but it is ours and we belong to it. We are in process, I read in the story. Now, St. Paul over in Thessalonians advises us to choose a spacious God. He lays out what's going to happen to us and our beloved at the end. When we've all died, or whether the end of the world has come and we are being lifted up towards grace, great religions all have some summation in them at the end. We have imagined that in the face of all the chaos and the dysfunction we've known down the centuries, there will be an opportunity when it all comes together in the hands of one who is wise and loving and who fully understands. I believe that imaginative thought comes from somewhere very deep and points us towards a hope and towards a truth. So St. Paul in Thessalonians says, make the dream big. Whisper your most sacred secrets into that dream where they'll be safe. And trust your dearly beloved to that dream, whether they be alive or dead. Go ahead, make the dream big, because the God is big, writes St. Paul. So choose a God with storage and shelving and display cases and a lock on the door, so that when you walk away, you know everything you value is there. And it is for you. Where your treasure is, there shall your heart be also. So the God of the cynic you meet on the way, and the God of the critic, and the God of the mocker are all too small. Pass them by. The God of literalism, the God of rigid orthodoxy is too limiting. Pass them by. We are children of something deeper. Something that takes us on the way to wonder. The little God of breaking even, or the little God of getting even, much of which we see in human relationships, is too bitter for us. That's no place to live. It just gives you ulcers and bad feelings. God is not a bodyguard or an enforcer for us and our little dreams. We are God's children and instruments. So choose a God who excites you, says the text, a God who bids you to come and play, a God with whom you want to sing, one with whom you want to fall in love, one with whom you can't help falling in love. That's the idea. Start waiting for the bridegroom now. Go on, even in the face of seeming absence, go out and choose the wedding gown and choose the flowers and order the caterer. Go ahead, because it's going to come and you have a hope about it. I was thinking about those five young women who had no oil in their lamps. How could that happen? Everything else seemed to be right. They got the invitation. They got the expectation. Their friends were all talking about the big event coming up. They wore their beautiful wedding garb, and they didn't have any oil in their lamps. Ah, you've got the lamp, the symbolism, but you don't have anything to make it light. And I was thinking, maybe they had broken hearts. Some people do. Maybe they had bad experiences along the way. Lots of people do. Maybe there was the thought that there is no bliss and no wedding and no bridegroom, and we're all just wasting our time. So we'll just stand here with these lamps, looking like everybody else, staying in the game in general, but our heart is not really in it. But we have seen how that works. Around this church, my colleague and I have seen how that works. We have seen weddings go bad. I remember a wedding in which the bride was out the front, and the groom was in the church, and the mother of the groom was in Barrie, Ontario. She'd missed the memo, 2.5 hours away. The bride sent her bridesmaid in 20 minutes after the wedding, saying, "What's happening?" "Well, mother is coming down from Barrie." "Oh." 20 minutes later, same bridesmaid. "What's happening now?" "Mother's at Bradford." "Oh." 20 minutes later, same bridesmaid. The bride says, "If we don't start this wedding in 5 minutes, she's taking the limousine home. The deal is off." "I can't be married without my mother," said the groom. "Well, meanwhile, the musicians who were to play broke down on the highway and never showed up, and we pulled in Dr. Wright from a meeting, who played a 5-minute prelude before she headed to Europe that very afternoon. Well, we went to the reception, one part of the family wasn't talking to the other. Welcome to the wedding day. We left early. More recently, there was a family came and said, we have a singer, and we would like to sing a special song with a karaoke background. Little red lights going on everywhere. One of the rules of thumb at the church is that all music is live at weddings, and all music must go through the minister of music. Oh, please, please. This is Grandma's favorite song, and she just died 2 weeks ago, and it will mean so much. Well, I don't know. Please, because she's been practicing for weeks, and it would mean so much. We'll just do it quickly. Well, all right. So the day of the wedding came, and the young woman stood in this pulpit, and we put the music over the sound system, the Philharmonic Orchestra playing this wonderful love song, and she started in, and she was halfway through the first verse, and suddenly someone from the street came and kicked the doors open and started yelling expletives all over the building in a great voice, and so the woman in the pulpit stopped singing. The music, of course, went on being karaoke. The ushers rushed from here to take the assailant out and throw him out on the lawn, and the thing was a mishmash, happy wedding. They started serving champagne early that day, as I recall. We choose our God every day in a world of wrong that can kill the heart. Choose a God with whom you can fall in love and wait for the wedding. The God of harsh options and pre-selected pressures, do it this way, fit in, do it or you will pay, is not on the agenda, but rather the one who says, hello, I love you, I have longed for this meeting, take my hand and walk with me. Because in truth, in the face of all the gods we're choosing in the shopping mall of this life, the real living God, the deep God whom we barely sense, is already choosing us and finding moments of awakening for us. I was reading a poem the other day by one of my favorite poets. His name is Lee Hunt. I didn't know much about him, so I Googled him. We didn't learn that word in seminary 40 years ago, but I've learned it now. I Googled him, and I found out that he was deemed not to be a first-rate poet, sort of a second-rate poet, but he hung out with some of the most remarkable poets of his time and writers of his time, and that he was a literary editor. And so he was great friends with Keats and Shelley and Browning and Tennyson, and that he lifted up the works of Charles Lamb and Charles Dickens and was very influential to them. And over the time, he wrote poetry as well. And he knew what love was, too. And he loved to live among the romantics who wrote so beautifully. And he loved the quest, and he loved the road less traveled on. It is said that when Percy Bysshe Shelley drowned and died young, and they were cremating his body, Lee Hunt went to Mary Shelley, the sister, and demanded the heart of Percy Bysshe Shelley to be kept as his own. And she agreed. And so they cut the heart of Percy Bysshe Shelley out of his body before the cremation and gave it to Lee Hunt as a treasure, the treasury of a friend long remembered. Now that bespeaks something deeper than a shopping mall visit. When I read one of his poems, I sense that he's seeking the God of whom I speak, choosing a God to whom I can relate. Listen, it is just so sweet. Jenny kissed me when we met, jumping from the chair she sat in. Time, you thief, who loves to get sweets into your list, put that in. Say I'm weary, say I'm sad, say that health and wealth have missed me. Say I'm growing old, but add, Jenny kissed me. Ah, I love that.